Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts, and I have so much to tell you today. First of all, to celebrate its fourth anniversary, the One Shot Podcast Network is having a Patreon drive. The network is funded almost entirely by listeners via Patreon. This pays for recording equipment and hosting and various kinds of support, including sending some of us to conventions. I could not do this show without the network. I just straight up couldn't. And that means I couldn't do it without you. So anyway, we're adding some new shows to the network, and that costs money. So if we can get to $7,500 a month on Patreon, One Shot is going to publish a follow-up to one of their most popular, and in my opinion, best actual play recordings of all time. If Feng Shui 3 sounds appealing to you, go to patreon.com/oneshotpodcast for more info. Second, I am going to be a very special guest at Big Bad Con this year. Big Bad Con is this wonderful gaming event held in Oakland, California in October. My being a guest there was a stretch goal on their Kickstarter, and it's already fully funded at this point, but the more that they fund, the more people get to go. Not just guests like me, but also the people who benefit from their scholarship program, which is so cool and really helps shape a diverse, inclusive, welcoming convention. I know everyone likes to say that, but they seriously actually, that's true there, for reals. It's chill and fun, and I would love it if you were there. And if you can't be there, I strongly encourage you to support them anyway. They have some nice rewards. You can find them on Kickstarter. Okay, finally, our guest today is Graham Walmsley. I met Graham at Dreamation a few years ago, where he ran his then-in-progress Disco World for me. I didn't know at the time that he was an Emmy Award-winning author and game designer who worked on games like Trail of Cthulhu and wrote Play Unsafe and Stealing Cthulhu, and who is now publishing his own inventive and thoughtful take on Lovecraftian horror games, Cthulhu Dark. The Kickstarter that, by the way, which you'll definitely want to check out, will go live on Monday, May 29th. But until then, enjoy this lovely chat.
Super softball, like friendly time questions. You went to Fairweather Manor, and I just want to hear all about it.
Fairweather Manor was amazing. So, so I mean, they do these LARPs in Polish castles, which are great. So the most famous one is College of Wizardry. Mm-hmm. But I've always really liked Downton Abbey, and so I wanted to do the Downton Abbey LARP. I wanted to go and be a servant. I had this idea that I just wanted to sort of go and be a really low-ranking servant for a weekend, and so I did.
Yeah, that's actually what's written here in my question is not just how you went to this cool LARP and I want to vicariously go through it through you, but also what about the idea of playing a servant was appealing to you?
Oh my god, it was fascinating. I hardly know where to start, so. It was a beautiful place. It was this big old manor house, but in Poland. And it was, yeah, so being a servant, I mean, it was a fascinating game experience for me. Because I'm always sort of interested in, interesting headspaces you can get yourself into in games, mm-hmm. or just interesting experiences that you wouldn't have any other way. And so what was really fascinating here for me was, I was definitely working, because you had to get up at 6:30. I mean, you weren't exactly cleaning the grate or polishing the floor, but you had to get up, and then you had to go to chapel, and then you had to go and dress one of the nobles, and you had to serve at dinner. So you had to stand there for 2 hours and serve people. But that was really interesting. So for me, it was this really interesting feeling of having to serve people and really wanting to do well, because you do end up wanting to do well, and working and playing this narrative at the same time, and that was amazing.
So tell me about your character's arc. Did you have lovely secret service adventures?
Yeah, so I played the lowest footman. I played the lowest male character who was 19, which is a bit of a stretch for me. And I'm trying to think what happened to him. So he had, like, someone who he thought was the love of his life. He'd had this, because we got to, like, arrange relationships before the game. And so one of the relationships I had was with a guy who was playing a film star. So there's this guy, Brett Sampson. It was really great having, like, a character who was a film star, but who actually wasn't playing a known film star. Because it's really funny, because you can basically sort of just stare at this dude all weekend, and you can go up to people and go, "Do you realise Brett Sampson is here?" And that's just incredibly fun. Yeah, so basically his first day was about being in love with Brett Sampson. And then at the end of the first day, he realised Brett Sampson was a bit of a dick. And, I mean, nice, but not someone you want in your life. And so then his second day was sort of this more complex story about, you know, just learning not to be obsessed with romance and just being happy with the friends around him. I had this, it was great. I had this little gang of maids. It was brilliant. So most of the footmen were all very much into kind of this male status play, and they were, you know, who's superior to who and so on. And I wasn't really into that, so I sort of abstracted myself from that. And so, you know, at breakfast and so on, I went to sit with the maids instead. And it was great. So I managed to get a best friend in the way you sometimes do in LARPs. Mm-hmm. And we just created trouble all weekend. And it was really funny.
That sounds really sweet. in Play Unsafe, which I've been reading, you have a whole chapter that's about playing with status, which I don't think I'd really seen that concept written out that way before. It reminds me of when people talk about playing to lose or playing to win. Mm. But I think you're talking about it in a more nuanced way than that dichotomy. How do you start working with status at the table or in a LARP?
That's interesting. I mean, I should say it's not my concept for a start. So Play Unsafe is all based off Keith Johnston's work. So how do you do it at the table? I mean, I think there's almost two sides to it. I mean, so the first is actually kind of physical things you can do, and that's quite a lot of fun. So, you know, if you sit straight, if you look people in the eye, if you're still at the table, and if you take up a lot of space, then those are kind of high status things. And so, yeah, you know, if you're GMing a game, or, you know, if you're playing a game, you can, if you want to play this sort of high status character, I mean, just try being still and comfortable in your body and just, you know, looking at people directly, not because you're trying to look at people directly, because, you know, that they're kind of yours to look at, you know what I mean? You can do what you want. So you can just
right.
So that's smart. And then, you know, the low status version of that is, you know, you don't look people in the eye, you take up less space, you kind of close in on yourself. And so I think that's part of it. I mean, just sort of knowing those little tips sort of is an instant sort of way into doing character things. But then the secret trick there, because when you tell people those tricks, suddenly they get all obsessed with the high status things. But actually the trick is that the low status ones are more fun.
Right, right.
And so it's fun to play, it's fun to play a character who loses and who isn't very confident. It's fun to play a character who defers to other people. It's quite a relaxing and lovely thing to do. It's a lovely experience for the other player. And so, yeah, just sort of playing the... Oh, and it's fun to be a quiet character. That's right, because everyone often tries to, like, do things at the table. But, I mean, if you ever, like, try being quiet at the table, that's a really interesting experience. So, yeah, just little tricks like that are really interesting.
Yeah. It's also very satisfying to be the quiet character, because then the one time late in the game where you, like, bust out a way louder voice, or you bust out some really, like, game-changing move, that's, like, so much more satisfying than if you'd been trying to do that all game, right?
Yeah, totally. Also, by the way, this is like an old actor's trick. If you're quiet and still, everyone looks at you. Like, if you want to steal attention, I'm totally serious. If you want to steal attention from everyone else, just be really quiet and still, and everyone will know you're there. It's brilliant.
And, you know, I think about the kinds of stories that you can tell with a low status character as well, right? Because it's not interesting to be at the top and then stay there, but it can be very interesting to do a rags to riches thing, and it can be very interesting to do like a fall from grace thing.
Yes.
What other kinds of stories can people tell? And particularly, what do you maybe not see being tapped into in role-playing games?
That's interesting. So, I mean, you've hit on the main thing, which is like changes in status. So, yeah, changes in status are, you know, incredibly dramatic, and quick changes in status are incredibly comic, which is an interesting one. So, yeah, you know, sort of a banker slipping on a banana skin is just kind of automatically funny because it's this sudden loss in status. What stories do I not see being told? Well, comedy doesn't get done much in role-playing games, which is kind of sad. I mean, you get very few comic role-playing games, and I'd love to see some more of those. I mean, like, I'm really tempted to answer that by just saying, you know, I really like nuanced stories, and I do, but actually, I'd love to see more comic games.
Why do you think that comedy is so hard to do?
I don't know. I mean, partly, comedy's really hard to write. So it's like if you read people trying to, like, the last Golden Cobra, one of the challenges was to write a comedy game. And one of the traps people fall into is by trying to make their text funny. And that's kind of not the thing. So, I mean, the thing is to, like, create comic situations. I mean, so, like, one of the best comic games from Golden Cobra is where you get a human living with an alien, and they have to sort of explain.
We are roommates now.
That's the one.
Yes.
And it's brilliant. And so I think those are the games that are really successful comically. So not the ones that kind of the whole thing is written in this quirky style. Right. But the ones that go that set up this comic situation. So the text isn't trying to make you laugh, but it's trying to give you the tools to, you know, for the players to create their own comic situations. And I mean, that's a really tough thing to do, but when it works, it's beautiful.
The text is kind of the straight man in that case, right? Like the we are roommates one, to me, that works if the text is like, you are in this very important situation. You are going to be ambassadors of humanity and, you know, this alien race. And so if it takes it all very seriously, then the payoff is when you actually play it out and the aliens are like, excuse me, you defecate in the same place you bathe?
Yeah. But I mean, that's really interesting. Like, so this is We Are Roommate by Wendy Gorman, and it's beautiful. Mm. And it's, I've got the PDF in front of me now. And it's like, it's brilliant. It's like this typewritten document, which someone has scribbled on, which is, it's brilliant. But I think it's really interesting what you just did, because, I mean, the funny thing about what you just said was that you were playing a high status alien. So, I mean, it's very...
Oh, you're right.
Do you know what I mean? Because it's, you know, if I'm playing an alien, I'm playing an alien who is complaining about humans defecating. You know, if I play that alien in a kind of alien voice, you know, I have noticed you've been defecating. It's an, that's a rubbish alien voice, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But if you suddenly play the alien as, you know, as posh, it's actually funnier. I've noticed that you've been defecating in a room which you have put aside.
Please explain, if you would not mind.
But that's great, and then it's also funny because you have posh people talking about defecating, which is funny too. So I mean, if you're talking about, you know, having a room to eat in, it wouldn't be funny, but if you talk about having a room to defecate in, suddenly that's funny. So yeah, make more shit jokes is the answer.
Yeah, definitely just fall to the lowest common denominator is our real advice here.
I think we will learn something today.
I'm glad we got to talk about comedy. I did not expect that. That was great.
No, but I think that's funny. I mean, I'm always fascinated by places that role-playing games don't go, and comedy is usually one of them.
Yeah. I wonder why. I wonder, like, everybody get on that. Everybody work on that. That's our... We've all proven that you can play games about very serious issues. It's decided. We've all agreed now.
Exactly. it's like, you know, the highest state of the art is to, you know, write really, really serious games.
Well, it's also like a bummer is, I don't know, and this is like so true of every like art form or whatever. It's like, I have made the greatest bummer. It will bum you out the most. Therefore, it is the highest possible art.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I have evolved into pure storytelling. Now I have made you really depressed.
Exactly. No, we're going to value only funny, silly, joyful games from now on.
Yeah, definitely.
Apart from yours, which are all... Well, I don't know. I don't think any of yours are bummers.
I'm trying to think. I don't know.
Well, let's talk about Will That Be All, which is a game that we got to play pretty recently, which is this really charming live-action game about the servants of a country manor, and you play out sort of a couple years in their lives in this... You know, each scene is like a New Year's Eve. So that's not a game where... You know, anybody rises to power or falls from grace or really like that's a game where not a ton happens. And it's not over the top silly, although we had lots of laughter in our run. But it's somehow immensely satisfying. And we all really enjoyed it and had good feelings at the end of that game. What is at the heart of a game like that for you?
Oh, man, there's about 10 different things at the heart of a game like that. I mean, so Will That Be All, like, brings together a lot of things I'm interested in. So one of them is writing about odd corners of history that people have forgotten about. And I don't think people have really forgotten about, like, servants in country houses, but I think we have kind of forgotten that there were people who were servants, and they were this whole class of people who now do not exist. You know, in the space of about 50 years, just 50 years, like that. 20, 30 years in the space of that time just disappeared. And so I think that's a very interesting moment in history to write about, that moment where they disappeared, which was basically 1945, running up to 1945.
Right. Gosh, I had never thought about that. The whole like face of labor would have changed.
It's a few different things. So, I mean, it's there was a slow decline. So Victorian times, which is the 19th century, was like the golden age of the country house, and you got these huge staffs of servants. And yeah, then gradually, like, people went off to get other jobs, and, you know, people could be factory workers, and so suddenly they didn't want to be servants anymore. And right. So there was a slow decline, but then there was this sudden stop in 1945, and that's when the war broke out. And the point is that at that point, the British Army requisitioned a load of British country houses.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's what happens at the end of the game. Huh. It's hard to appreciate the, like, we can appreciate the emotional impact of that in the context of the game. And I hadn't even totally really connected it to, like, a broader historical context of what was happening.
Yeah.
Okay, so interesting little semi-forgotten pieces of history. Or at least historical periods from the perspective of people that we don't necessarily hear a lot from.
Yes, very, very, very much so. Yes, that's very important. I like the idea of sort of hearing voices we've forgotten. That's very important. And I like the idea of... And because one of the things about Will That Be All is, I think if you read the characters, their ideas about romance are very different from modern characters. And so that's a thing as well. So, you know, I quite like the idea of someone who wants to get married just to someone who will provide for them. And that's genuinely what they want. Because I think that's not really a thing that happens these days. Or, you know, they want to get married to someone who'd be kind of quiet and wouldn't bother them too much for sex.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just find it fascinating. I mean, the idea of like someone wanting someone like that these days seems very odd, but it was a thing.
And all of that change, like there are lots of reasons for changes like that, but so much of it is just material. Like just the fact that like it's relatively speaking easy for a lot of like a lot more people to just live on their own and do their own thing and not really exist in like a nuclear family now.
Yeah.
As we're materially, right? That would have been so much more challenging for folks then.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah. It's definitely a game with a lot of like very subtle and genuine queerness in it, you know?
I hope so. And I think it has, the queerness tries to be queerness of its time.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say, yeah.
So, I mean, queer identities have changed over the years as well. Mm. And so the idea of people being gay, we're actually a bit too early for that in the 1920s and 1930s. There was a different language about then. And so I find that very interesting, just the different kind of ways that people identify, or the ways they wouldn't identify. So, I mean, you know, in those days, it was much, much more common for straight men to have sex with men. And it was a thing. And they weren't gay, but, you know, they would just, as young men, they would, especially young working class men would have sex with older middle class men. And they weren't gay. It was just a thing they did before marriage.
Yeah. Well, and again, this is part of that is like a product of, because people's sexuality is fluid and it always has been and presumably always will be. But like, again, that's the result of like material circumstances, right? Like you don't have a ton of access to the opposite sex at a certain age, you know, like sex outside of marriage is like not just frowned upon, but just like difficult logistically, like not something that would have been very easy to access. As where having access to other people of your same gender, particularly if you were like in the military or something like that, yeah, there would have been tons of that.
Yeah, totally. And actually, even more. I mean, I think about half of it is material. I mean, because I think there's the other thing, like just the ideas of, you know, of queerness and sexuality and everything that were about then were very different. But yeah, I mean, so there's this, I mean, it's very, very directly material because, I mean, if you were, you know, if you were a young working class soldier or something who slept in barracks a lot and didn't get a lot of privacy, one of the ways you could kind of experience a bit of luxury was by getting an older, overtly homosexual man to take you for tea or let you have a bath in his rooms in return for a few favours. And so that just gets really interesting because I mean, it's a very direct material transaction here. Or they take you to the cinema, you know. You didn't get to go to the cinema much, so you did.
Like, even today, you still see echoes of that, you know? Like, if you go on Craigslist, there's lots of, like, hey, not gay, I totally have a girlfriend, let's just hang out and we can jerk each other off and then whatever, we go on our things. No gay stuff, please.
There is a whole fantastic book about that, which I think is called Not Gay. Yeah, which is about that idea of, you know, men who identify as straight having sex that in other circumstances we would think was gay, but they're very definite it's not. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to make fun of that at all. You know, it's very, very interesting.
See, more interesting places my interviews go when I don't prepare too rigidly, which is also something you talk about in Play Unsafe.
Yes. Although I don't quite mean it, because, well, I kind of do mean it, but also I do loads of preparation for games, so I'm kind of a bit disingenuous in that book.
Well, what is the, like, how do you feel about that question now? Because it's something that I still notice in particularly new GMs who are running games for the first time. They tend to, you know, make maps and write down a lot and make these huge notes and prepare a lot in advance and often have like a frustrating experience their first couple games because of that. And yet at the same time, not every game can just be like totally played from, you know, shot from the hip.
Yeah, I agree. And like, if I'm honest, I mean, I do talk in Play Unsafe about how you can, by the way, do you realize that book is 10 years old?
It's bonkers. I didn't think we were going to talk about it at all because I was like, well, I guess I'll take a look, but like, this thing is an ancient tome. Like, surely nothing of relevance could still be in here. Like, this must be stuff we all know by now, but alas.
So, I mean, if I'm honest, I mean, I prepare for games. So I do talk about in Play Unsafe about how you should not prepare for games at all. But I think what I really like these days is just more of a sense of spontaneity. So I think half the point of Play Unsafe is this idea that you can overplan. So a lot of the time we try and like plan ahead to like guarantee fun. And actually, I mean, if there's one message at play, unsafe, it's that actually that doesn't guarantee fun. And if you're spontaneous, and that's spontaneous in the sense of, you know, relying on the thing that's just popped into your head, then that thing which has popped into your head is probably better and more fun, and you'll probably have more fun yourself if you just go with that.
Right, which also plays into your notes about not trying to be clever and not trying to be unexpected and not trying to be entertaining, but rather being super obvious and boring, which is really counterintuitive advice, and yet it remains extremely good advice.
Yes. And by the way, this isn't quite my advice, you know, I mean, a lot of this comes from, I mean, you know, do go and read Impro by Keith Johnston. It's an amazing book. I've kind of applied it to games. Well, the thing about being boring is that it's not boring. That's the thing. I mean, so the ideas that seem boring to you are actually, and seem obvious to you, are actually seem really creative to other people. I think this is the thing about horror as well. You know, so, because I'm fascinated by horror. Because again, it's that thing of like putting you into a weird headspace. And I think one of the most interesting things about horror is when you're really obvious.
What do you mean by that?
Okay, so I was thinking about this earlier. So I was thinking about an old scenario I wrote, which was for Pelgrim Press. I don't know if you've heard of them, Alex, Pelgrim Press.
I think maybe.
I wrote this thing called Cthulhu Apocalypse for Pelgrim Press. And so, I mean, this was like my love letter to post-apocalyptic games. This sort of English post-apocalyptic thing, which isn't so much about Mad Max, but is much more about waking up and realizing the world has died, and then just wandering about looking at the dead world, which is the kind of thing I love. But one of the main threatening things in that was white flowers, which grew everywhere. So you wake up and you find everyone's died, and there are white flowers everywhere. And so once I had that idea, I mean, it's really easiest to just riff off that and just, you know, do obvious extensions to it. So, like, there's white flowers everywhere. There's beautiful billowing white clouds in the sky, but they're not actually clouds. They're just like clouds of seeds from these flowers. And then all the streams, when you pass a stream, you see it's white. And again, you know, when I say white, that's because it's just packed with these seeds, because these flowers are everywhere. And then you wander into a town and there's corpses there. But then when you look closely, these little white flowers are growing in the corpses. And so and the corpse is like decomposing, as though decomposing too fast, you know, as though the flowers are like feeding off the bodies, like breaking it down as they grow. And as I say all this, I mean, I'm not making this up because I wrote this a few years ago, but this all seems really obvious to me. I mean, you know, you've got white flowers, you've got corpses. Obviously, the white flowers are growing in the corpses, and obviously they're using it as food. And to me, this just seems like I'm kind of saying this very obvious thing. But when I say that to people, people go, that's really horrible. And so I think that's kind of the essence of doing horror well, is to just like delve into your little subconscious a bit. And just sort of produce the things that it spits out.
What do you think stops people from being really obvious?
I mean, the classic answer is just that they're a bit afraid of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people are afraid of the things that their brain will blurt out. And I'd love people to trust their ideas a bit more. And not feel that they have to be right the whole time. Because I think this is a really, you know, big thing. I mean, because your thing of, like, the GM, like, drawing all these maps and things. I mean, if they were drawing maps that they were very excited about and they're like, fantastic maps, then that would be amazing. But what they're probably trying to do is, like, worrying about those maps and going, you know, is this a good adventure? Is this, like, something people are going to enjoy? Do I need to put more combat in here? And I mean, with all kinds of things, I would like people to break the rules a bit and kind of, you know, create the things that they want to create, rather than following the rules in an attempt to create what they think is the right thing to create. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, say what they're supposed to say. Or try to somehow predict what everyone else at the table is going to think is cool, instead of saying what you think is cool.
Yeah. It's a massive thing in Cthulhu games, which mm-hmm. is that... I mean, one of the things I really hate is canon. And you get some... No, I know.
Don't get me started.
But I mean, in Cthulhu especially, I think a lot of people go into... into you know, running Cthulhu games, thinking they have to do about 20 years reading to get it right, and it's tragic because because apart from anything else, you know, Lovecraftian horror is meant to be about unknown stuff, and the place people often start is by going, okay, I must learn everything that's ever been written about the Maigo. And, you know, they've got these zappy lasers and they help people go through space and so on, and gateways and da-da-da-da-da. And of course, by the time they've done all that, there's no room for personal imagination. I mean, I'd rather just people go, this is what I want the Maigo to be about, and that's what they're about now.
Yeah. How can something be scary if you know everything about it because you read the wiki?
Yes, totally. I would like people not to read the wiki. Or to go and edit the wiki and just put surprising things in there.
Right. I really wanted to ask you about the appeal of Cthulhu stuff or of Lovecraftian horror in general. Because it's one of the most popular sort of wells to draw from in tabletop games. And I have never really understood the appeal of it. And so I'm really interested in your perspective on that. What about that makes such good inspiration for games for you?
Yeah, I mean, I can only explain for me. I mean, I can't try to explain why people like it in general. So for me, the first time I read a Lovecraft story, it creeped me the hell out. So I read Dagon, and it was one of those books that just stayed with me. You know, I had a shower that night, and I can remember, like, the, you know, feeling the water on my skin and just still being a little bit disgusted by the world. And so one of the things I really like about horror is that it can put you into this weird headspace. So, I mean, you know, we spend a lot of time at gaming tables aiming for, I don't know, meaningful experiences or fun experiences, but I really like the idea of, I think, although I can't explain it, I think there's something quite important about exploring our fears and our disgust and just wallowing in that for 2 or 3 hours.
And what about Lovecraftian stuff? Like, what separates that from other horror?
I mean, for me, there's a few things, but... I mean, the most noticeable thing about Lovecraft is that you can't solve the problem. So, I mean, this is one of the things that really spooked me out when I first read Lovecraft, because, I mean, you read, you know, a horror story or a horror-inspired story, and, I mean, basically it goes, you know, you discover something bad, and then you discover it's really bad, but then you put it right and it's okay. And Lovecraft goes, you discover something that's a bit weird, and then it becomes weirder, and then you realise it's even weirder, and then you realise it's controlling the world, and there is nothing you can do about that. And I come out of that and go, oh my god, that's very odd.
What happens when you spend time in that space?
It puts your head into a weird space. I don't know. it's like going into an art gallery or watching, you know, or watching a very intense film, and so you come out just kind of noticing things a bit more. It gives you a sort of new way of, if I say a new way of looking at the world, I don't mean a horrible way of looking at the world, but it's just so intense that it absorbs you for a while, and you can come back out of it afterwards.
Yeah.
I'm probably not doing a very good job of actually sort of, you know, selling Lovecraft, but I also can't, don't want to, in a way. It's quite I find it quite personal. But I think exploring our fears is a really interesting thing to be doing at the gaming table. And I'm really tempted to get very philosophical about this and kind of, you know, Well, it's going to be rubbish if I do. So, but you know, but I'm really tempted to say, and this is really important because, you know, it gives us a safe environment. And maybe all that's true. I don't know. But I think there's something very important about exploring fears. I think there's something quite important about exploring people who can't trust what their minds are telling them. I think that's very interesting. I mean, you know, in something like Dungeons and Dragons, we never take account of mental states. So we never play a Dungeons and Dragons game where you fight a dragon and then you wake up at midnight thinking, oh my God, I killed a dragon, and just reliving the whole thing. And then looking over the shoulder, your shoulder for the rest of your life. And whenever someone lights a fire, you see it in the corner of your eye and you go, oh shit, the dragon's after me. And we never do that. But that, for me, is an important human experience. That idea that we're not always rational and we do react too much to things. And, you know, sometimes we're stupidly anxious about stupid things. And sometimes it just seems that the right thing to do is just scream at the wall for a while. I don't feel that all the time, but, you know, that I think that is an important human experience to be exploring. And so that's one of the reasons horror interests me so much.
That's really interesting to get into this non-rational headspace. Mm. It's very easy to be rational at the table, right? And to be removed from things.
Yeah.
But which is not really the way that we experience the world most of the time.
And I think Cthulhu games kind of make you do that. So they put you in the role of people who, you know, from the outset are not seeing the world quite right. Or they have a very, you know, or maybe they are seeing it quite right, but they can't explain that to anyone else. And that's...
Right.
Yeah. Oh, can we talk about Iron Fist quickly? Iron Fist.
About what? Sure. Okay. Yeah, so, tell me about Iron Fist.
Sorry, I had a weird realization about Lovecraftian gaming while watching Iron Fist, which is quite funny because people don't like Iron Fist.
I've heard it's quite bad.
I've heard that too. I'm quite enjoying it at the moment. But the backstory behind Iron Fist is that, and this won't be a spoiler particularly, is that there's this guy who his airplane crashed and he was taken into a monastery. It's kind of supernatural monastery which only appears at certain points in time, and he trained for 15 years as a monk and then he came back to New York. And one of the really interesting things, in the second episode of Iron Fist, this guy goes into a psychiatric hospital. And one of the things I found really interesting was that this guy tries to explain, honestly, what's happened to him. And honestly, what has happened to him is he crashed in a plane and he got taken into this monastery which appears only at certain points in time. And of course, as soon as he said that, everyone thinks he's crazy, but he's really just seeing the world as he saw it. And I think that's quite, for me, that's quite an important human experience. I mean, this was a like quite a meaningful episode to me, even as people were slagging off this series on the internet, and there's some very, very good reasons to slag off Iron Fist. But this was quite a meaningful episode to me. And so I think, yeah, it's that thing of, you know, you know how the world is, but you try to explain it to people and they look at you as though you're not speaking sense.
Huh, okay, that's really interesting. Mm. So you're making this game, Cthulhu Dark. Yes. What about this game demanded to be made?
So many things. So Cthulhu Dark comes from so many places. And it's been kind of going in one form or another for about 5 years now.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Cthulhu Dark started by me going, maybe you could just write a really short Cthulhu system that fits on one page. But then when I wrote the system, I realized some really interesting things you could do with the dice. So I, you know, this is the thing we don't do so much in games anymore, but back sort of 5 or 10 years ago in indie games, we thought a lot about like little tricks you could play with the dice.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of tricks you can do. There's all kinds of tricks that Cthulhu Dark does with the dice, but one of them is that when you're investigating something, the higher you roll, the more you find out. but if you roll too high, you can find out too much.
Oh, I see. Your brain can't really contain all of this. Oh, that's neat.
I mean, so I think that's one thing that's different, which is that the rules are really interestingly engineered to push the story in different directions and towards horror. Mm-hmm. There's a few more tricks. I won't go through them all, but there's a few more tricks like that. There's other things as well. I wanted to give some new writers a start.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided, one thing that was bothering me about 2 or 3 years ago was that we talked a lot about diversity in games, but actually, if you picked up most of the major rule books, they were all written by dudes, like every single name.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they were kind of always the known faces. And so I decided when I wrote Cthulhu Dark that I wanted to give some new people a chance. And so I made up my mind that I would have co-authors, but they wouldn't be like all the normal people I write with. They would be like new people I would go out and find. And so that's another place Cthulhu Dark is coming from. Like it's me writing my stuff, but it's also me going out to find new people who are writing really exciting stuff. And so, you know, you have Catherine Jenkins, who's written about Arkham in the Time of Witches, which is awesome. And Helen Gould, who's written about this fictitious African country called Jeo in the present day. And it's just awesome. So, I mean, that's one thing I really wanted to do. Like, when I published Cthulhu Dark, I wanted basically to put something out there that went, no, actually, you can do this. You know, you can just write a book which has a completely new team of writers, and where I'm the only dude who's part of the writing team for the main book and things like that.
That sounds very satisfying.
Yeah, it's really nice to watch it come together now. Well, it's nice, and also I can't stand reading it anymore because I've read it over and over again. Which I know is not the best selling point, but I'm so... I'm sometimes so tired of it, and then sometimes I'll read something, usually something by Catherine or Helen, and I'll go, oh no, that's really good. And then I'm excited again.
So having a team is a way of keeping your energy up then. Keep your spirits up. You don't have to just read your own stuff over and over again.
Because I get excited by stuff other people write. And both of those authors write stuff that really excites me. So Catherine writes really gruesome stuff, which is horrible. And then Helen writes really beautiful descriptions. And that's really exciting. And the art as well. I mean, one of the things, you know, so it's this guy, Matteo, who's done this most beautiful black and white art. And I just found him on the internet. I found him on DeviantArt, which is a source for artists. And he had the most amazing art. And so he would send me, both him and Catherine would send me these really creepy things, always late at night. So I was just going to bed and you'd open this thing and you go, whoa, I didn't want to see that. And yeah, so those people are personally responsible for ruining my sleep.
Wow, that's great. That's such a good measure of, you know, you've hired the right people when they're
totally.
Keeping you up at night. How exciting. Okay, we're done talking about your project.
Okay, that's good.
And I really want to ask you about learning tango.
Yes,
because I really want to talk about that, because the lead follow dynamic in general is something that in a game design perspective is of particular interest to me right now. And I know that you've done a couple of different kinds of partner dancing, but tell me about tango. Tell me what you're learning at tango these days.
Tango, I really like tango. It's hard to just start talking about it. So I started dancing tango because I thought it was a very elegant thing to do, and also because dancing really scares me. Like with some people, it's singing. People hate singing publicly, and I like singing publicly. But dancing, I find really quite embarrassing because I feel very physically uncoordinated. So I did it to push myself a bit. And tango's really, really interesting. So leading and following is a really fascinating thing. So in a lot of dancers, and especially tango, there's one player who leads, which means they indicate what the dance is going to be, and they indicate which step's coming next. And there's one person who follows. And that sounds really simple, but it's actually really... I mean, the real beauty of tango is that you can get together with a partner. So I could... I mean, it's actually quite hard, but I could get together with another person who dances tango. And we could start dancing steps together. And it's as though we're in each other's heads. And we, you know, we each instinctively know which step's coming next. And it kind of looks like magic. But actually what's happening is there's like really subtle cues in the way I'm leading and in which the follower would then be picking up. And so that's really fascinating. And it's really interesting how subtle it is. Firstly, it's really interesting how in the body it is, which of course is something we never think about in games.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, dancing is it's quite intimate. You're holding someone, and you're guiding them around with your body. But actually, you're kind of not. You don't want to be like pushing someone around a dance floor. That's a very uncomfortable experience. And so, I mean, when leading in tango, often what you're trying to do is you're trying to be very clear, but at the same time you're trying to give the other person a really good experience. You're trying to like give them the best dance they can ever have. And then when you're following, you're trying to put your trust in the other person and follow their lead and kind of, you know, feel their tiny little moves and their subtle hints and try and get inside their head a little and follow what they want you to do. And so there's this fascinating dynamic there.
Are we going to get to see this dynamic in future game designs?
I'd like to. It's really tough, though. I mean, obviously, like, it's in my head. I mean, how would you write a tango game? Oh, I understand there is a tango game out there already.
Yes, yeah, there is. Can you remember the name of it?
In Fair Verona. I really want someone to run it for me. But I find it really interesting because... I mean, it would be hard, right? Because, I mean, when we were at Fairweather Manor, we did dancing, and it was a really big part of the game. So we did waltzing. There's this wonderful couple called Jeppe and Maria, who taught waltzing at Fairweather Manor, and it was just some really, really basic steps, but it was enough to kind of get you moving together.
Mm.
And so that's beautiful. And I mean, certainly for me, dancing was this big part of my story at Fairweather Manor. I found out I was dancing at all the interesting points.
And, like, you don't have to become a master waltzer for a couple of basic steps to become almost a mechanic, right?
Yeah.
And when you play in Fair Verona, I'm sure you're not learning very advanced tango skills, but you're getting just enough that you can start to have the interaction that a lead and follow dancing have.
Yes. Definitely. Although I think then it gets very interesting because I mean I think the fun of dancing is sort of knowing how to do it. So I mean it's very hard to give someone the experience of dancing from scratch. So it's very hard to do that in a sort of 3 or 4 hour game. So yeah, the idea of sort of marrying those two things together is very interesting. And then I end up thinking like things like, you know, I mean, let's say I kind of wrote a tango game which was set in Buenos Aires in 1890, something like that, and I invited everyone to come in costume and dance. And you kind of think, would that actually be a game, or would it just be like a costumed dance event? And what's the difference there? What would you have to... Because you can imagine like costume dance event, so come in costume and I'll decorate the room and you can all dance to old music. And then you kind of think, so what would you have to add in to actually make that into a game? And I find that very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you would not have to give people much more than that for them to show up and have a really good time.
Yeah, I think that's one of the very interesting things about Fairweather Manor, actually. And Fairweather Manor taught me something quite important about game design. One of the things that the organisers of Fairweather Manor really try to do is they make sure there's always something for you to do. And so it's such like a basic thing, but... I talked to Klaus, who organises College of Wizardry and Fairweather Manor, and loads of those games. And so I sat him down at a conference and made him tell me how he writes games. And so one of the things is that he always makes sure there's something to do. So there's always an activity, or, you know, even if you finish with one thing, dinner is only half an hour away, and then after dinner there's speeches and so on and so on. And so I think that that's just such an interesting way to think about games, that actually maybe you don't need to think so much about narrative, but you want to be thinking about structure and just giving people these... it's almost like giving people toys to play with. So rather than like designing a game, you're just trying to give people these little fun things to interact with and go and do. And I think that's a very interesting thing to think about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Magiscola was largely based on College of Wizardry, and there was a lot of that philosophy there as well, where there was always, if you didn't want to do something with your house, you could go and join a club. If you didn't want to do something with a club, you could, you know, you were going to be in classes all day. There was a pretty tight schedule, and teachers could assign homework, and you really didn't have to do the homework, but... like, for some players, they actually did the homework, which I was genuinely surprised by, but they wanted to because maybe they were a bit shy or maybe they weren't into any of their clubs, but doing the homework was something that they could do to, like, be in character and win house points and whatever else. But
yeah,
I think you're right. People will kind of take care of themselves and make their own little stories and things, but just giving them something to not be bored by. And those also have to be, like, reasons to interact, right?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
If I could ask you about one more thing, it would be about...
You can keep talking, by the way, Alex. I'm really enjoying this. So.
No, we'll just keep going. It'll just be a special double episode.
and now in this episode, it's more of Graham talking bullshit.
The new series. Our hot takes on all the latest game things.
Oh, Jesus. Now Alex and Graham are talking about geography.
Next up, Spanish Civil War.
Don't get me started.
I want to ask you about food.
Yes.
In games.
Yes.
Because I didn't get to play in Marinara, and I was very bummed out by that. Right. But everyone I talked to who played in Marinara had this really amazing, like, beautiful experience when they were describing it. So, first of all, tell our listeners a little bit about Marinara. And then, after that, I'd like to hear a little bit about where this game came from.
So Marinara is sort of a game which is almost so simple I can't believe nobody's written it before. But it's a game about food and emigration. And so it's a game about a family, so three generations of this family come together every year and they cook pasta alla marinara. And the game starts, everyone brings an ingredient to the meal and you taste the ingredient. You write a few things down about your ingredient. Because this is a thing I really like to do. I like writing about games. So I have this thing where I get people like taste their ingredients and I ask them to imagine time slowing down and to focus really intensely on the taste and then, you know, bring the feeling back into the room and then just scribble a few words down about it. As they taste their ingredient, they taste it twice. So the second time they try to get something new out of it. And then they taste one of their ingredients with another person's ingredient. They taste one of their ingredients with another ingredient which they think will go well with it. And then I get them to taste their ingredient with an ingredient that they think will be quite a challenging combination. And each time they're writing something down. And then you use all that to make characters. So...
Yes.
Yeah, so... I mean, this is the obvious thing. I can't believe... I mean, it probably has been done somewhere before. But anyway. So, you know, you use the things you wrote about your own ingredient to make your own character. And then when you tasted your ingredient with another person's ingredient, you use that to describe your relationship with that person. And then it goes from there, really. So then you have this sort of big, bubbling relationship web. And you play a family drama. And I tell people at the start that in terms of playing a family drama, I mean, there's two stereotypes for a family drama. The first is it's all saccharine and lovely, and we're all bonding and together as a family. So that's one. And so I tell them not to do that. And then, but actually people don't do that. The other one, which people will head towards unless I stop them, because of Nordic LARP. Thanks, Nordic LARP. Thank you, Nordic countries, for messing up family dramas. So the other stereotype is that the family will come together and they'll rip each other's heart out and that, you know, all their secrets will come out into the open and there will be pain. And so I tell them not to do that either.
Right, yeah. Everybody's abused everybody. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, it's not a proper story. unless a family hates each other. So yeah, so I tell them not to do either of those two things, but to sort of portray a family, you know, with tensions and with warmth, but probably one that sort of has some bond, that, you know, so that it is still a core story about coming together, even though it doesn't mean everyone's sort of, you know, it's not this sort of necessarily this warm, loving thing all the time, but there is some bond beneath it. And so, yeah, they come together and cook a meal and do that.
I love that. Not only do their ingredients represent their characters and then their relationships to each other, but the fact that all of them then end up going into the same sauce. Like, you're right, that almost is a little too obvious, but
yeah,
it's good. It's resonant. It works.
It's quite funny because, of course, I had to pick the cuisine right. Mm. So you couldn't do that with French cuisine. So, you know, pasta a la marinara is kind of perfect because you have all these ingredients which you can eat raw. And then, but if you cook them together, you know, this sort of magical fusion happens, which is great. But, you know, if I tried to do that with, coq au vin or a French dish, you can't have people eating raw chicken. And then it would take, the beauty of the Italian cookery is that you can basically just throw it together and it works. Because it can be rustic. Apologies to Italian friends. Mm-hmm. I realize there's actually a lot of skill involved. But you can just throw the ingredients together and they work.
And it will be edible.
Yeah.
You will not ruin it. Yeah.
Whereas if I did sort of other cuisines, then it wouldn't work.
Right. If everyone were making macaron, you know, it would be a very long game at the least.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm still trying to do like the dessert course because I'd really like a second act in marinara where everyone brings one ingredient for dessert and then but I can't think of one.
It's really hard to think of a dessert that isn't made with like something that you can't eat raw, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Or that, again, that everyone can just kind of toss together.
Yeah.
Maybe you can make like little panna cottas or little creme brulees or something.
Yeah.
I've never made any of those things, but...
That needs skill though, doesn't it?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe it just means something if it all just falls flat and curdles.
It's like the end game. And then if it falls flat at the end, then your family is a disaster. And that's not happening. But so that's the game, and I'm really into those kind of in-between stories. So I spend quite a lot of time sort of aiming for almost like moods that are in between two other moods. And so, yeah, with marinara, I'm definitely aiming to get people to negotiate that tension between, you know, a family all bonding together, and the fact that they're actually very different people and probably don't all bond together very easily. Oh, and I have to tell you, one thing I find fascinating about games is that there's often like one thing that happens, and it's not in the rules, but it seems to happen in every game. So like in A Taste for Murder, which is my murder mystery game, there will always be incest.
That was not clear from reading it. It does not say, make sure you add some incest.
I know, it's not like a rule, you know, now pick the incest player. But no, there's something about the rules that pushes you towards incest in that game, which is weird. And in Marinara, there is almost always a character who has... there's almost always a woman character who is dating a woman... But she's told everyone else, she's told her family they're just in a relationship. And so halfway through, it comes out that she's a lesbian, and there's a brief moment of shock, and then she's welcomed into the family. That's like the standard thing that happens in Marinara.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
How many times have you gotten to play Marinara?
I mean, I haven't played it, of course. I've run it, is it three or four times? Something like that.
Because, you know, it's not something that can just be bust out at any old convention center in any old hotel, right?
No.
Which is lovely, part of the magic.
Sadly not, but it's good for house cons.
And I think, I don't know, have you gotten to play it with people who are not normally into LARP? Because those are the games that I'm always looking for.
Yeah, I haven't, I don't think. And I wonder how it would work. It's one of those games that seems very simple, but maybe it actually relies a lot on storytelling skills. I'm not sure.
But I mean, speaking of giving people something to do, right? The pot must always be stirred.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
Do you have a game that you like to go to when you're playing with new players?
Oh, with new players? I don't know. I haven't got a brilliant answer to that. Sorry.
Good. Only brilliant answers accepted. No regular answers. Perhaps we should tie things off here. Okay. It was really nice chatting with you.
Thanks, by the way, Alex. This has been really lovely, really fun.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's been really fun to have you on. I always like when we get to chat.
See, we didn't talk about Disco World at all.
Oh, that was totally in my notes. Oh.
And that is like, because that's a game that feeds into everything we've been talking about.
Oh, see, it's been lurking beneath. And I also forget that, like, so few people know that game and have gotten to play that game.
Mm.
And that's how we met. You ran a game of Disco World for me. And I was like, Oh, this is so amazing. That was like, That was my first Dreamation. That was pretty much the first time I went to a con and had like an unqualified good time.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, that was special. And it was the first like con I'd ever gone to where I got to LARP. And I made so many friends there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's because you're very nice.
Aw, thank you. Well, you know what, though? Speaking of Disco World, you say something in Play Unsafe that's like, it's on the very last page, I think, and it's super off the cuff. But it's something like, and by the way, ask your players. Like, ask other players. Just turn to them and make sure that what you're introducing is okay. Just say, like, I'd like if I killed your character's wife. Is that okay? Yeah. Or, like, I'm going to try to stop you from doing that. Does that sound fun?
It's one of the things they were very good about in Fairweather Manor. But one of the things they sort of said at the start of Fairweather Manor was you can break character for a moment and just ask someone if something's okay. And, you know, and this is okay. It doesn't, like, ruin people's immersion or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a real eye-opener for me, actually, because, you know, you don't often think that. And then there was something that happened. I went to Knutepunkt this year. And there's a really wonderful initiative there, which I think is it Tyra Grasmo and Hannah Grasmo?
Mm-hmm.
And it's it's called Dare to Ask, Dare to Tell. And Dare to Ask means it's always okay to ask someone, are you okay? And Dare to Tell means if you're not okay, it's okay to say so.
Right. And, like, what an empowering way of putting that. I guess it's something that, unfortunately, really has to be called out.
I thought it was a really lovely, lovely thing. I mean, interesting, I was, you know, there were a couple of nights at Knutepunkt when I actually really wasn't okay. I mean, I think the first night at Knutepunkt, I was like, I don't know anyone. And and people, you know, some people did ask me, and so someone said, are you okay? And I was like, actually, no.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting one. Because you don't naturally ask people. You naturally think they've probably got something going on. They don't need me going up and hassling them. But if you've got that rule that says, this is okay, you know, it's all right to ask, then you do. And it could be very important.
I think having permission to answer honestly may be even more difficult, right? There's, I think a lot of people, I guess I'm just speaking for me personally, there's like a lot of pressure to say like, no, I'm good. I'm fine. Everyone else is, I assume, is having fun, therefore I have to insist that I'm having fun.
Yeah, or you kind of think, well, I'm not brilliant, but I'm not so bad that I need someone to take care of me, so I'll just say I'm fine.
Right, right.
Other people have far worse problems than me.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I feel terrible, but not so terrible that someone has to do the totally minimal work of just, like, chatting with me for 5 minutes. Well, we talked earlier in the show about games from the point of view of people I can't think of the right way to phrase this, perspectives that are not the dominant perspective, basically.
Yes, definitely. And voices that have been forgotten is another, I mean, it's a different thing, but it's sort of, it's related.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fascinated by the history of disco.
Me too. And people don't always realize, because when they think of disco, they think of the Bee Gees.
Yes, yeah. And so disco has been sort of made into this sort of white camp thing, or white straight thing, actually, whereas actually it was, you know, very much started as a queer thing, and even more importantly started out as a kind of Puerto Rican and black thing in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on where you start, you know, And,
yeah.
Oh, and, yeah, and there were lots of sort of Italian-Americans as well involved. So.
Yeah. So Disco World is not just a game about the history of disco.
No. So it's, I mean, I wrote Disco World soon after doing Just a Little Loving, which is a LARP, which is very explicit about sort of love and sex. And so Disco World is kind of my response to that. And so there's fairly direct sexual topics in Disco World. And again, I think it's trying to sort of remind you of a time that's been lost and ways of thinking that have been lost. I mean, one of the things we've kind of forgotten is this idea of dancing as a communal experience. You know, that you could be part of the crowd and sort of all moving together. But I think almost we're so individualistic these days that that kind of thing sounds like a bit of a nonsense. It sounds like a thing that, you know, can't possibly be the case. But if you read how people described disco at the time, it was this very communal experience. Oh, yeah, so you know, like the classic image of disco is John Travolta on the floor and everyone looking at him and waving their hands. But I think in a way that's a bit of it's a bit of a mistake, because disco, for me, reading back about it, because I wasn't there, it's much less about like this individual who is an amazing dancer. It's about the crowd. And if you go and dance, you don't want like people to look at you. You want to blend in.
Yeah, and there's a real sense of like togetherness or people finding their people.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think all of the, if I can recall, this would have been a couple of years ago now, I think all of our characters were people who weren't totally comfortable where they came from.
Yeah.
And were able to find this place where they really felt like they belonged. So it's really a game about like belonging. And the fact that there's lots of drug use and sex and all kinds of, all of that feels like a vehicle towards this other kind of intimacy, which is this communal intimacy.
Yes. Yes, that sounds right. I don't think the drug use is written into the game.
Oh,
but it often finds its way into the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, so Disco World takes place in, I think you get scenes in the outside world and then scenes in the disco, and they alternate. And the scenes in the outside world are generally quite oppressive. And then the scenes in the disco are the escape.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's deliberately sort of geared to sort of show you the outside world, but then give you a place of release. I think one of the really interesting things about Disco World for me is I sort of thought about it in terms of story structure. And one of the things I was really trying to do with the story structure was, I mean, rather than following like a classic story structure where you kind of, you know, it kind of ramps up and then you reach a peak and it goes back down again and you end, I was trying to make the story almost like dancing. So, you know, that feeling where it ramps up and it keeps going and it keeps going and it peaks, it peaks, it peaks, it peaks, and then it ends. And so that's what I was trying to do, to sort of, you know, keep it building and building and building, just getting even more and more intense. So just when you feel, you know, you're all working together, playing the game, and it's all perfect, then it builds even more. And so, yeah, I was trying to build that.
Do you feel like you succeeded?
Kind of. I think Disco World's a funny game. It's not one of those games. I mean, I think Disco World is the best it will ever be. And it's a quirky little game, which I really enjoy. I don't think it's this perfectly engineered little game. So I don't think that anyone could just pick up Disco World and start playing and it will be a perfect game. And there's games I've written that I think are really quite well engineered. So I think Will That Be All is, you know, works pretty much straight out of the box. But Disco World doesn't. I've forgotten your question.
I was asking if, because you talked about this sort of ideal arc of a game of Disco World and how it feels like a dance, and I was asking to what extent you feel that you succeeded in that.
I think that succeeds in Disco World. So the idea that at the start people, it feels quite mundane, and then it builds. I mean, the intensity, I mean, if you play it, I think the intensity and the love around the table generally just builds higher and higher and higher, and then you stop and everyone kind of goes, oh, that was lovely.
Yeah Which is exactly a good dance.
I remember sitting there with you after playing Disco World, actually, and there was just this... I almost didn't want to leave the table after playing Disco World because it was like there was just this lovely little bubble and I didn't really want to leave it.
Yeah, that's the other thing too. And I remember for that game, somehow, even though it was a tabletop game, we managed to get like a room to ourselves. Which is such a precious commodity at a convention. I had that for playtesting Tension at Metatopia, even though it's technically a tabletop thingy. And oh my gosh, what a difference. And Disco World is one of those games where you really feel like you can create this tiny little world. Like you really do feel a little bit separate from everything else when you play it.
Oh, by the way, I think I got the room to myself because I told everyone I'd be playing disco music.
Oh, you're right, yeah.
It's amazing how you get rooms to yourself. You say, I'm going to be blasting out disco music.
I think you had like a little light too, like this little coloured light that you had just on at the beginning.
Yes.
Yep.
I love the music for, because when I run Disco World, I have this soundtrack with me and it's taken from different clubs in the time of disco. And so the soundtracks are all different and there's this kind of progression through them. And it's really interesting.
You're going to have to share that playlist. It's probably just a collection of MP3s you have, but if you could put it on Spotify or something, that'd be so delicious.
I'll try. Yeah, that would be good actually. And a lot of it comes from reading books about disco. So there's two books. One is called "Turn the Beat Around" by Peter Shapiro, and one I think is called "Love Saves the Day." I can't remember the author of that one.
I'll find it. I'll track it down and put a link in the show notes because I'd love to read more about disco.
Mm. Well, those are two histories of disco by British authors, weirdly. But they're both very good.
So, you know, you've mentioned that Disco World is kind of a quirky game, and it doesn't really work with everyone. Like, it's not something that anyone can just pick up, bust out, and it'll run.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think Disco World requires of its players?
Of its play, I mean, what I think Disco World requires actually is a good GM. I think it's a game that fits very much into my GMing style. I mean, again, as opposed to something like Will That Be All, which I think hardly needs a GM.
Yeah. When we played Will That Be All, John Stavropoulos ran it, and he kind of came in, helped us set up, left, and then he basically just showed up for about 5 minutes in between scenes, and it worked like a dream.
I know. When I run Will That Be All, it's actually really boring.
Yeah, I bet.
And people just talk to each other for 45 minutes. I have nothing to do. But Disco World, Disco World fits very much with my GMing style. And that's kind of what it needs. I mean, in terms of the players, I don't know. I mean, it's one of those games that wants you to bring your own imagination to the table and not hold back. Because it's a game that, I mean, in Disco World, you're sort of given a bunch of dreams. And then you're basically told to fulfill all of them. And you're told not to hold back. Right, so you have like five dreams in front of you, and the rules are basically try and fulfill all of those at once, you know, as many as you can do. And once you've fulfilled them, try to like fulfill them, but even more so, like take whatever the next step. And I think that's quite a disco thing. So it's this idea of the utter utopia, this like, you know, this total pleasure all at once, and you can have everything. And again, I've totally forgotten your question, the idea of Disco World being a utopian game, I think, is very interesting.
Right, because you really do have to play it, not just like you are in the 70s, but like the 80s will never happen.
Oh my God, yes, yeah. Well,
like it's really important. Like it's important that you just completely toss yourself into this, like, into this feeling that, like, now this is it. This is the new world, and I can just live this way and. There will be no terrible, terrible conservative backlash at any point in time. So it needs a good GM. What does that mean to you?
Oh, that's a horrible question, Alex. Did you have to? I mean, it does depend on the game, right? Because, you know, a good Cthulhu Dark GM is different from a good Disco World GM. I think in Disco World... I mean, to be fair, in a lot of games, I think it's very much about listening to the players. about sensing what they want. There's a very interesting thing about pushing the players. So almost like sensing what they want deep down and trying to get them towards that. I don't know quite how to explain that.
I think I know what you mean. Like, there's a lot of, I mean, in the game we played, there's a lot of, like, giving people permission.
Mm.
Right? That sort of gentle, like, do you want to do this scene? Because it seems like you might be kind of interested in this, and we can go there if everyone at the table is interested in that. Right? And you're looking around and paying attention and listening. And then saying, okay, like, you can.
Yeah, totally. And of course, if someone says no, that's not super.
Yeah, totally.
Sometimes I'll turn to people in Disco World and I'll kind of go, what does your character want? And then I'll go, and what does your character kind of want really deep down? And then the deep down one is the revealing one.
Wow, yeah.
Because often they'll be pacing themselves. You'll get this character, you'll get a character who's sort of exploring their sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And so... They'll say something like, I really just want to, like, dance and be close with people. You know, I don't think my character's sort of, ready to do anything sexual yet. At which point I will often say something like, deep down, if the chance came, would they do that? And there's the sense that people, like, pace themselves in their head, so... Mm. It's a very delicate thing because there's a consent thing there, and I'm trying not like to tap dance around that too much.
Yeah.
But there's also kind of a subtle thing that happens in Disco World and in that sort of disco world, where it's meant to be about, how to explain this, like doing things you didn't realize you could do.
Yes.
There's this kind of dream at the back of your head. And you go and you go, well, I'm not going to achieve that dream tonight, and then you achieve the dream. And so there's quite an important thing about Disco World, which is going, at the back of your head, what's your character hoping will happen here? And then you get, people will say that, and they'll say, but that's not necessarily going to happen now. And then sometimes it happens now. But there has to be a lot of talking the way through that. I mean, do you know what I mean? I'm obviously just not throwing it at that. I'm making sure people are okay with that the whole way through.
Of course, yeah. Like, I think the GM in Disco World, especially in the disco scenes, there's a lot of just describing what is there, right? There's like, these people are doing this and this kind of music is playing and this person is giving you these cues. But all of that is just sort of around you versus a game where, you may be framing scenes really hard or, tossing things at your players that they have no way to get around. And both of those two different kind of modes of play or kinds of stories actually do require different watching for different things and maybe different skills and different techniques.
Yeah. Although now I'm kind of wondering, whether they're actually the same to a large extent. Like, because you're absolutely right. Like in Disco World, what you want is someone walks into a disco and you want to basically describe all this stuff around them to tempt them.
Mm.
And you don't want to say, and now this happens. You want them to say, I'm going to go and get that.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, the first thing you kind of say is there's people dancing on the floor, and then there's this dark corner where there's sort of movement over there, and there's this back room, and where'd you go?
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm sort of wondering if when I'm GMing a Cthulhu adventure, I do similar things, because in a way you're kind of similarly challenging people, and I don't know, Cthulhu GMing is very interesting.
Right, that's true. I mean, I guess in a Cthulhu adventure, you're still just presenting things, and it really is up to the players who are often, investigators. They're looking into something that may screw them up very badly, actually, and that maybe they shouldn't be meddling with at all. But it is kind of, the agency is theirs to go and pursue that and to look into that and decide that it's worth the risk.
Yes, I mean, it's quite a strange thing to say in a Cthulhu game, the idea that the agency is there. But yes, I know what you mean. Because what you want in a Cthulhu game is for everyone to be signed up to that idea of they are on this path to destruction. Because if they are sort of playing to preserve themselves, then they just won't have a fun game.
Yeah, it's going to be a very frustrating experience for them.
I think one of the things I find fascinating about Cthulhu games is that when you're GMing, you often find yourself kind of saying things again and again. So often, like 15 minutes into the game, you've actually told people what the horrible thing is. And then for the next 2 hours, you're actually saying it more and more clearly. So, like, you know, for example, if you're doing a game, this is a game, an example I talk about in Cthulhu Dark, but if you're doing a mystery which is about a child disappearing, then, you know, the first thing the investigators might find out is, I saw him disappearing from his room, climbing out of his window, and there's this man, this sort of strangely looking, elongated man, and they walked off towards the docks. And if I say that, it's actually, you know instantly that this child has been kidnapped by monsters. But then, so for the rest of the game, all you do is you say that more and more clearly until eventually they find a bunch of children being kidnapped by monsters. And so what you're doing in Cthulhu is you're kind of confirming people's fears through the game.
Mm.
And you really want to get to the state where they're going, it's not, you know, it's not as bad as this, is it? And you go, yeah, it is. And then they go, well, but, you know, there's not more than one child, is it? Yes, there's more than one child. And do you know what I mean? So there's this kind of lurking fears at the back of people's minds. You just want to bring those out into the light.
See, I've often wondered about that when it comes to, I guess, horror, and particularly like supernatural horror, because to me the tension has always been that you're trying to play these characters who wouldn't suspect there to be a supernatural monster, but at the same time, you as a player have signed up for that exact situation, and so you're just going to think everybody is monsters everywhere. So I like what you're saying about the slow reveal and the slow amping up about what is truly horrific about this situation.
Mm. But I think there's a role to be played by the player, actually, which is if you're signing up for a Cthulhu game, then, you know, the best kind of player is the one who just comes in denying that there's a monster and comes in with their heads. And you know, there's a part of them as a player which knows what's happening. But they're like, oh, he walked off towards the docks, and I'm sure there's a rational explanation for all of this.
Right.
And that's fantastic, because then, you know, then they're like setting themselves up to be knocked down later, and I love all that.
Yeah.
I might go and have dinner now.
Same, actually. But anyway, if my listeners want to keep up with you and what you're working on, where should they do that?
I'm on Facebook, and if you're interested in Cthulhu Dark, there is a Cthulhu Dark Facebook page, so you can go there. I'm on Google+ and Twitter as well.
Great. I will include links to such things in the show notes. Again, thank you so much for joining me. I'm really, really glad we got to do this. It was super fun.
I'm really delighted. It's been such a lovely conversation.
Yay.
Well, thanks again to Graham for joining me, and as always, thank you for listening. If you want to get in touch, remember that you can email me, that's backstorypodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet at me, @backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can find more great shows, which will now include Shadowrun Campaign Actual Play Neo Scum, an actual play of One Shot fan fiction stories called Adventure, and the Car Talk of RPGs, System Mastery, all at oneshotpodcast.com. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more at soundcloud.com/UJICO. Talk to you later, heroes.